ومالي عن ام
العراق.
I think most Americans know, but we just can't come to terms with living, with coming to the reality that the reason that we're there for is for our own self-interest.
Iraq was a profitable way to, for our government to kind of, you know, stabilize the oil markets and also just have a presence there. I think that's really what we're trying to do.
Well, they say they invaded Iraq for all the stuff that they had, and they didn't have anything. So it was all a lie. Big lie.
Well, I think the United States is in there mostly for oil. We're just trying to use Iraq as a way to control the Middle East, control our interests in the Middle East. And, you know, it's obvious that the Bush agenda since the beginning has been to go into Iraq, and they just use September 11th as an excuse.
All they care about is oil and all of the stuff that doesn't even deal with the so-called democracy that exists today.
The weapons manufacturers making the money that is spent on the war in Iraq, as well as Bush getting his oil, and I think it's about imperialism and about Bush's money.
Saddam Hussein, the president of Iraq, Afghanistan, I think, he bombed the World Trade Center with the planes.
We heard it a lot of times.
Baghdad, April 2003. A city which had seen numerous conquering armies now fell to the armed might of the United States. In the days after the U.S. invasion, the pillage of priceless ancient treasures from Baghdad's museums symbolized the destruction and humiliation America brought this land, the cradle of civilization. Iraq, the ancient land of Mesopotamia, the Greek word for the land between the rivers. Over 5,000 years ago, the Sumerians created humanity's first stable city-based agricultural society, invented the plow and writing. This is where law and accounting were invented, and where the Old Testament placed the Garden of Eden. Down through the millennia, the flow of human migration, war, and conquest brought a succession of civilizations. In the 13th century, Baghdad was destroyed by the invading Mongols, and the region remained economically weakened until it fell under the domination of the Turkish Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. Under Turkish rule, which lasted until World War I, Iraq consisted of three administrative provinces: Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra. By the end of the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was in decline, and the Middle East had become a scene of growing rivalry among the world's colonial powers. A resource that transcended all others, oil, provided the fuel for the expansion of European and then U.S. imperialism in the region. And oil made the Middle East what the U.S. State Department later called the greatest strategic prize in history. The Anglo-Persian Oil Company, now British Petroleum, began producing oil in neighboring Iran in 1908. Winston Churchill converted the Empire's ships to oil in 1912. Airplanes and tanks made their first combat appearance in World War I, underscoring petroleum's new strategic value. During the war, the British, most famously through their operative T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, promised independence to the people of the region, provided they allied with Britain against the Ottoman Empire. At the same time they were promising independence, the British and the French were negotiating the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement to carve up the Middle East between them. The British got Iraq, Palestine, and Jordan, and the French took Greater Syria, including Lebanon. Like his American counterparts today, British General Stanley Maude declared after taking Baghdad, "Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators." The new rulers of Mesopotamia and their imperial cartographers further inflamed the region by detaching oil-rich Kuwait from the province of Basra and formally making it a British colony. The British-French betrayal triggered a revolt for the independence of Syria, Palestine, and Iraq. The people fought so fiercely that British leaders used chemical weapons against them. Winston Churchill said, "I do not understand this squeamishness about the use of gas. I am strongly in favor of using poison gas against uncivilized tribes." Confronted with massive resistance, Britain's Lord Curzon proposed creating an Arab facade behind which the British would rule. Modern-day Iraq was created at a closed-door meeting of British officials at the Semiramis Hotel in Cairo, Egypt. Two pro-British Iraqis were present to witness the scene. The British anointed one of the sons of Sharif Hussein, the Hashemite ruler of Mecca in what is now Saudi Arabia, as king of Iraq. His brother was made king of Jordan. There was no Iraqi national anthem, so during the coronation, the British military band played "God Save the King." Their puppet King Faisal was forced to sign a 75-year concession granting the foreign-owned Iraq Petroleum Company all rights to the country's oil. The British ruled Iraq directly and indirectly from the end of World War I until a nationalist coup overthrew the Hashemite monarchy in 1958. After World War II, British hegemony in the Middle East was challenged and eventually supplanted by the American Empire and its voracious appetite for oil and power.
We apparently must, in this country, colonize the people in Colombia, the people in Grenada, the people in Panama, the people in the Philippines. Every decade, every year, every month, bombing brown people. How people get elected here. How people run their politics here. It's been going on since 1846. It's been going on since 1790. How did it start here? How can it be stopped? Hallelujah.
This wasn't a war to liberate anyone. This was a war of conquest. And most importantly, this war was not a diversion, as a lot of the mainstream Democrats describe it, from the war on terror. It's the embodiment of the war on terror, which is actually a war of terror against the people of this planet for greater empire.
I think the most immediate purpose is oil, I have no question in my mind, but the more long-term issue is a strategic. Control of the region of the Persian Gulf area that a substantial interest of United States as an empire and any other potential imperial tendency by China or Russia or Europe. As potentially. So United States is positioning itself in a place that can have global control.
The problem is that empires, whether it's the British or the French or the Germans in the 19th and 20th centuries, or the American Empire before it became a global empire, always act in their own interests. That's the only reason they're there. It's in their own interests. It's not to do the good. It's not to do a war of good versus evil. It's a war of national or imperial self-interest. That is why they are there. And the reason why the whole region is dotted with military bases, and you have the largest foreign base of the United States, the Al-Adid base in Qatar, a tiny principality. That's where you have it. Why? Because of the oil. Now, I don't think the war in Iraq was exclusively about oil, but oil is ever present in the discussions. And if you read these memoirs dictated by Paul O'Neill to Ron Susskind, which have been published recently, they are very revealing, saying that the plan to take Iraq predated 9/11 and was discussed within the first 3 weeks of the Bush administration being in office, including how they would divvy out the oil. Now, this is O'Neill talking. This is not some conspiracy theorist in cyberspace.
What is going on, as much as these have become cliched buzzwords, is true. It is imperialism. It is about dominating the world. And they themselves are actually not that shy about that. I mean, it's in all these documents, New American Century, and all that stuff. I mean, it's a very concerted, sophisticated plan to be the number one power. So we're not conspiracy theorists. We're not people with nothing to do who just likes to say anti-government stuff. Anyone who wants to pay attention, just look at these documents and look at, most importantly, beyond documents, look at the action. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. There has not been one shred of evidence.
Right now, statistically and point of fact, the operation in Iraq, which was predicated on the assumption that Saddam Hussein was in control of the weapons of mass destruction, have been proven to be wrong. I mean, they cheated and they lied their way to this war. Against the will of the world, both in United Nations and in the February 15th demonstrations, globally, in the streets by people who demonstrated against this war. They have not been able to produce a shred of evidence connecting Saddam Hussein to weapons of mass destruction.
One reason for this. You don't reduce this to one reason. There were many reasons for this, which is why they focus so laser-like, as Clinton used to say, on Iraq. Taking down Hussein was seen as a way to shore up the U.S. position in the Middle East. It was seen as a way to shock and awe the world, to intimidate not only the masses of people, but other countries. Taking down Hussein was also seen as a means to fuel this war on terror and embolden people with a quick victory and keep the momentum going from September 11th. This is why they were in a rush. Remember, the UN weapons inspector said, why don't we take our time? Why don't we wait? Bush, oh, no, no, we're in a hurry, we're in a hurry, we can't do that. Why couldn't they? Because every day they waited following September 11th, the connection between that emotional horror and this war would be diminished. That's why they were in a hurry. You know, it's interesting, now they're trying to cover this whole thing up by blaming the CIA and claiming it was all about bad intelligence and refusing, of course, to investigate themselves and how this intelligence was fabricated. And this is simply an effort to prevent people from understanding the history and the agenda that I'm laying out here.
These are not conservatives. They are radical, reactionary statists. They have a very narrow hold on political power. They must maintain it in order to carry out that program. You see it day by day in the legislations produced and the actions undertaken. And they have an international program, which has been announced, dominating the world by force permanently, preventing any challenge, and in particular controlling the very crucial energy resources of the world, mostly in the Middle East. Even if it does increase the threat of destruction, in fact maybe destruction of the species, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, terror of which the population of the United States will also be subject sooner or later as before.
Every single place, every single location on Earth, Iraq, Afghanistan, Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, anywhere that U.S. military presence is evident and palpable, you will have an increase, global increase in number of terrorism. The war on terrorism increases terrorism, not decreases. Look at the evidence. Right now, what happens in Chechnya and in Russia, for example, in Somalia, in Morocco, in North Africa, in Central Asia, in Malaysia, Indonesia, in Western Europe, globally and statistically, we are more prone to acts of terrorism and more acts of state aggression. That is, you have US and UK and any number of allies that they can mobilize committing horrible acts of illegal wars. The war in Iraq was illegal and immoral and had no backing from the United Nations.
I think it's totally hypocritical, and I think it's totally self-interested and materialistic. And I think Cheney and all of them, and I think they have, it's proven that they have an agenda with Pearl and Wolfowitz and so on. You know, they had a plan to reorganize the Middle East.
I think it's odd that we feel so justified doing this when everyone's telling us it's wrong, when the people of its own country are saying we shouldn't be here.
Lower the minimum wage.
Wait, we have a question. Wage. Just why are you in Iraq and why are you staying there?
Oil.
Important of all, the job would require men, hardy men, determined men, men who were willing to leave families and friends and journey halfway around the world on a quest that might end in failure. And each man had his own problems to weigh, each his own decision to make, for they were being asked to make a life career of oil in Arabia.
We're rich. We don't need to fight. We let poor people fight for us. Poor people can fight for us.
We want it all. That's their attitude. They want to tear down other imperialist rivals. They want to crush any states in the third world who stand in their way, Iran, Libya, Iraq, whomever. They even want to further open up their allies to globalization and global capitalism, like Saudi Arabia, globalization at gunpoint.
The collapse of the official stories about weapons of mass destruction and terror they did have consequences. In fact, ominous consequences. The most significant consequence of the collapse of the story about weapons of mass destruction was that it changed the official doctrine that if a country has weapons of mass destruction, the United States is entitled to attack it in anticipatory self-defense. What's called in the press and some commentary preemptive war. It's just a euphemism for direct aggression. As the doctrine's been changed with the discovery that there were no weapons of mass destruction, so that now the United States has the right and authority, sovereign right, to attack any country that has the intent and ability to develop weapons of mass destruction. Okay, that's a significant change. That lowers the bars on aggression very significantly. In fact, it makes it universal. Every country has the ability to develop weapons of mass destruction. Any country with a high school chemistry and biology lab.
Where were the two first wars of this unbounded, never-ending war on terror? They were in first Afghanistan, Central Asia, second Iraq, the Middle East. These are the areas which together have 80% of the world's oil and natural gas resources. This isn't a diversion from the economy. This is how the capitalist class aims to strengthen their economy and solve their economic difficulties. This is not a war waged for a few corporations. This is a war waged on behalf of all of U.S. capital, all these multinational corporations. And this isn't Bush the cowboy. This is U.S. imperialism the cowboy trampling on the rest of the planet.
What we have is the massive destruction of the infrastructure of a society, a systematic killing of innocent civilians, or poor people who have been grabbed by the throat of their poverty, a military uniform put on their back and sent to maim and murder other people around the world. A systematic looting of the national heritage of a country. We have systematically destroyed a nation state, and our own civil liberties here in the United States have been systematically compromised. Oil corporation, gas companies, Halliburton, all of these companies, I'm sure they will end up with extremely lucrative contracts coming from this operation. But we like to think that this is a democracy that is serving the interest of 260 million population of this country rather than the specific interests of corporations.
What was the first thing we saw during this invasion of Iraq? The first thing that came after the troops was convoys of gasoline trucks to fuel the Humvees and the tanks and the helicopters and so on. So if you have a globe straddling military, and this country has troops in 120 countries around the world, you have to have huge amounts of petroleum and energy to fuel that war machine. The second thing is the impact on the economy. Global capitalism in significant ways has been built on cheap Middle East oil. Don't believe me? Believe Henry Kissinger. The basis of Western prosperity, cheap Middle East oil. The price and supply of oil has an enormous impact on the profitability and on the competitive positioning of all these capitalist corporations.
We're not building democracy in Iraq. We know that for a fact. We know for a fact that there will be no elections. There will be no transfer of power. There will be no transfer of sovereignty. There will be no removal of U.S. military troops. There will be no revoking of the illegal imposed economic structural changes that Paul Bremer and the U.S. authority have imposed on the Iraqi population. None of that will happen. So, you know, so what is this job that we are intent on finishing unless we do want, if we, the American public, are willing to sacrifice our men and women and to sacrifice our own humanity by killing thousands of Iraqis to finish the job of controlling other people's resources and empowering the rich in this country and empowering military bases?
This is the foundation of the entire global capitalist system, and in particular the competitive position of U.S. capital. And that's the final point, the third point. Oil is a weapon of empire. If you control the flow of oil, you control those who depend on oil.
A 7,000-year-old civilization slid into anarchy on live TV. Vandals plundered shops, offices, hotels, and hospitals. American and British soldiers stood by and watched. They said they had no orders to act. In effect, they had orders to kill people but not to protect them. Their priorities were clear. The safety and security of Iraqi people was not their business. The security of whatever little remained of Iraq's infrastructure was not their business. But the security and safety of Iraq's oil fields were. Of course they were. The oil fields were secured almost before the invasion began.
This is my third time in the demonstration. My third time in the demonstration.
That's the only thing we want. We want Bush to stop doing war in Iraq. The way the guys are not saying, so why
is it so? He wants oil, and oil pollutes trees, air, and water. What's the use of oil anyway? It's not even there. Occupation is a crime, too.
Empire is on the move, and democracy is its sly new war cry. Democracy, home delivered to your doorstep by daisy cutters. Death is a small price for people to pay for the privilege of sampling this new product. Instant mix imperial democracy. Bring to a boil, add oil, then bomb.
The United States has already had a busy day attacking.
And it was shocking, and it was awesome. And bombing on a scale that was shocking, all
shocking off. Shocking off.
If you have to ask, is this shocking off? You're not seeing it.
Community rates low on an information scale when the press, radio, and other channels of communication are controlled by only a few people, and when citizens have to accept what they are told. In communities of this kind, despotism stands a good chance.
Before the war started, there was an awful lot of coverage about how the journalists were going to be covering the war. They were in training camps. They called them boot camps for journalists. They talked about embedding and how they were going to be with the troops. And this, of course, was a big change in Pentagon policy, because for Grenada and Panama, the press had been locked out of covering those wars. And also for the first Gulf War, a very small group of elite journalists were in a pool, and they were the only ones that were able to get any information.
Tell me why the Pentagon seems to want you guys, want us,
to accompany these units into the front of the battle?
Well, I think for two reasons. I think one is that the Pentagon realized that given the nature of miniaturized and extremely effective satellite communication systems that we can carry around with us on the battlefield, handheld satellite phones and the such, they realized that it's virtually impossible for them to effectively control us, and they would prefer, I think, to have journalists with the troops, with the military forces.
So you got not only very positive coverage about the fact that the Pentagon was changing its policies, was now going to be so open and show the American public war as it really was, and allow journalists to kind of come in and be part of that and be the American public's eyes and ears. So the beginning of the war was characterized by enormously positive media coverage. Well, the embedded journalist, while it looked really good on the surface to have journalists following with troops, and certainly historical precedent where it had resulted in important coverage, the difference with Iraq was that journalists were really having to work under some pretty rigid constraints. They had to stay with troops that they initially were set up with. They didn't have their own vehicles. They had no independence. The soldiers that they talked to were not able to talk on the record to them, so they couldn't kind of give them background information or give them criticism without knowing that they were going to be revealed, their identity.
Media mobilization. At least 500 reporters, photographers, and television crew members will be assigned to the military to cover a war with Iraq near the front lines. The military will provide them with protective gear in the event of a nuclear, biological, or chemical attack. And currently, 232 journalists have already been trained boot camp style for combat conditions.
With embedded within the troops, not being able to be independent, not being able to move from place to place, established a particular kind of relationship between the journalists and the troops. And that's a classic strategy of public relations. It's all about establishing a relationship. And once you've got that positive relationship established, then you've pretty much formed the perspective of the journalist, not only physically to report from the American military's point of view, but also mentally and emotionally, that you have no journalistic distance from your topic.
The identification with the troops and with the military became so intense for some reporters that they actually were engaged in picking out targets. One of the most striking examples is that of Gavin Hewitt, a BBC reporter, a very senior BBC reporter, who has said this publicly, that he was with a US military unit and that he noticed that some Iraqis were about to fire on them, or he thought they were about to fire on them, and he pointed this out, in effect pointing out targets to the military, and they then targeted these people and then blew them up. And he crossed the line there from propagandist to active accomplice in war. Now, if you see the war in Iraq as an illegal war, in effect an accomplice to war crimes.
The way that the journalists then functioned with troops was to do what they know, which is to put the war within a reality show. And it conformed really to a type of format that was already on television, where the excitement of going along live with somebody in a very dangerous and restricted environment, where the journalist is bringing you, the viewer, along in this empowering perspective when you're looking through the camera, and gave it the aspect of entertainment and excitement and glory and all of the positive things that we now associate with that brief moment between March and April of the Iraq reality television, right? Where you're looking through the camera, you're in the Humvee, and you're tearing through the desert, and you're on your way to Baghdad.
Camp New York. It's the home of the 3rd Infantry Division from Port Stewart, Georgia. A long way from home, but tonight we bring a little bit of home to one of the sergeants in the 3rd. For now, this is Sergeant Charles Weaver's family.
Did you call your wife?
A new band of brothers preparing for the first war of the 21st century.
And I think some of us may have forgotten, but they were stalled. They were stalled, and there was a sandstorm. They encountered more opposition than they believed. And something that finally made the Iraq War real were the carelessly slung bodies of American soldiers on a slab floor that was aired in Al Jazeera and Iraqi television. This was horrible. We got the sense that finally the war looked like a war, and it was far too real for the Pentagon, though they had promised us, you know, to really tell us what a real war was like. And that lasted for a few days, and it's not coincidental that shortly after that is when you had the daring do rescue of Jessica Lynch. This is interesting because it wasn't embedded journalists. It was actually military cameramen themselves, called combat camera, who essentially staged what they said was a raid in the hospital to rescue Jessica Lynch. And it was, of course, amplified and embellished in the media that Jessica had been, in a daring do raid, ripped out of the hospital in the middle of the night, where they had taken on fire from the bath party. And it was very much hyped and sensationalized in the U.S. press. As it turned out, of course, there were no resistance in the hospital. The hospital personnel had tried to deliver Jessica Lynch the day earlier to American troops, that it was very much a staged battle, and that the media had very much exaggerated it. And if it weren't for the BBC's investigative reporting going into the hospital afterwards and actually talking to the doctors, getting the real story, we really wouldn't know what the real story was.
She's had two things she wanted most: visits from her family and applesauce.
After the Jessica Lynch story, pretty much the war was starting to wind down, and in terms of U.S. coverage. But if you remember, the statue was toppled in the square in Baghdad, and that was really marked the iconic visual symbol for the American victory of moving into Baghdad, is pulling the statue down. Many things were also wrong with that story, where if you looked at the pictures close up, it looked like there were a lot of people in the square. If you pulled the camera back, the square was practically empty. The final end, where the war is finally declared over, ends with a Top Gun moment, if you will, very reminiscent of the movie where the president's wearing a flight jacket and he flies on to the USS Lincoln in the San Diego harbor.
The White House announced today that President Bush will deliver what amounts to a victory speech.
Is on board the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln.
The White House chose the location for tonight's address aboard a returning aircraft carrier as a metaphor.
The president chose to fly in on a Navy jet because he wanted to experience landing on a carrier short deck and the adrenaline rush that comes with it.
Maverick. Play with his old man.
If you had to go into battle, would you want him with you?
I don't know. Just don't know.
Don't. Tim, maybe you and I wouldn't look that good in a jumpsuit.
This kind of imagery, how important is it to projecting an image for the American voter?
Well, you know, all of these images have very profound impact, from the Jessica Lynch to the USS Lincoln, and then you have Saddam Hussein being found in a hole, and then kind of having the doctor look into his mouth, that picture repeated over and over again, kind of making him look like an animal or under a microscope, something that's being inspected. And again, it's an image that shows you utter domination of a foreign power, in this case the utter success of the U.S. military in finally finding the man, unlike them never being able to find Osama bin Laden.
You are free. You are free. To do as we tell you. Do as we tell you.
the U.S. media acts as a spokesperson, a mouthpiece for the Pentagon, even to the extent that we're seeing phraseology that's put out by the U.S. government PR machine repeated over and over again on every single media outlet.
U.S. surgical bombing, the strategic strike,
targets of opportunity,
target of opportunity,
a target of opportunity,
Iraqi leadership, decapitate,
decapitation,
decapitate.
What happened is 7 years ago, there was a channel launched in the Arab world called Jazeera Satellite Channel, which is also a 24-hour news service. It basically raised the bar for everybody else as far as news is concerned, because it was freedom of press is a new concept, relatively new concept to the Arab world. And because of Al Jazeera, every other channel has had to follow suit. So there have been strides made in the past 7 years towards the freedom of the press in the Arab world. And Al Arabiya is following in that tradition, in the sense that we're giving you faster-paced news, breaking news as it happens all around the world internationally, but with an Arab voice, because that is lacking in the market. Trying to give you the Arab perspective on the story, because there are two sides to every story. And of late, especially with the war on terror, the other side of the story has been an Arab side of the story. So we needed to get that voice out. We needed to get an Arab perspective on what's going on in an Arab backyard. So Iraq, Saudi Arabia, the Palestinian territories, places like that needed to be told from an Arab perspective.
And if books and newspapers and the radio are efficiently controlled, the people will read and accept exactly what the few in control want them to. Government censorship is one form of control. A newspaper which breaks a government censorship rule can be suspended.
Americans saw, you know, courageous, daring do reality war, and by and large, a good deal of the rest of the world saw civilian casualties. They saw children who couldn't get help in hospitals. They saw limbs blown up. They saw the destruction of bodies and wounds that these kinds of weapons inflict on people. The American people didn't see that. The rest of the world did.
One thing to point out about these precision weapons,
it's expected to totally sell out.
In the Gulf War I, about 10% of the weapons were precision or guided either by laser or by satellites.
The gold alone, that's 4.5 grams, mm-hmm. at today's market, that's your $99 right there.
This time around, it's just the opposite. 10% are so-called dumb bombs, 90% precision. It's amazing how the weaponry has changed over the 12-year period. This is a plane that is not easily seen by radar. These bombs that we're talking about, mini bunker busters with about a 500-pound warhead on them, designed with a time fuse so they penetrate concrete.
This president...
A couple of our journalists were in Baghdad covering a story. They were covering a bombing of a Baghdad hotel, which has been a trend in the past couple of months. And as they were approaching the checkpoint that the American soldiers had set up for that whole zone, they've sort of cordoned off the area after the bombing, they were stopped by the military, the American military. And another car that was tailing our car sort of sped past, and the American soldiers started shooting at the car that surpassed the checkpoint, and in the process shot at our car and killed two of our journalists, two of our reporters, a reporter and a cameraman.
The U.S. strikes also killed a journalist from the Arab TV network Al Arabiya. The network broadcast harrowing footage of its correspondent, Mazen Al-Tumaizi, reporting from the scene when he was hit by shrapnel. Mazen doubles over and his blood splatters on the camera lens as he screams, "I'm a journalist. I'm dying. I'm dying."
the last 2 days were really difficult for us. He was around us. He was here. We can see him in every report he did before. And the most horrifying thing that we heard him saying to his colleague, "Saif, I'm dying. Come to me. I'm dying. I'm dying." It was his last words. And this was really terrible.
War protest. His opposition to the war on Saddam, unpatriotic. Should Americans join the president and rally around the flag? Join the heated debate.
Last year, in the early days of the Iraq War, there was a huge demonstration in downtown Manhattan with 100,000 people marched from Midtown down to southern Manhattan, and it ended up on page B11 of the New York Times in the metro section. It didn't even make the front section. That's the first problem. The second problem is that when they do cover it, they will often single out the most inarticulate person in the march or in the crowd, or somebody who might be said to appear exotic to mainstream American viewers, the person with the purple hair or the person with the hardware hanging from their face. This seems to be done intentionally to marginalize the thinking, the ideas behind the peace movement.
Besides a protest, it's like deciding, well, I'm going to decide policy based upon a focus group. It's upon a focus group. It's upon a focus group. It's upon a focus group.
And we found that 71% of the sources who appeared in stories about Iraq were pro-war. But just 3% of those sources on those same shows were against the war. But actually, that 3% overstates the anti-war perspective on these shows, because invariably those anti-war sources for these news shows were quoted in one-sentence sound bites from the street. Not a single leader or spokesperson for the peace movement was invited into the studio for a sit-down interview during the first 3 weeks of the war. That was opposed to the 71% who were pro-war voices, many of whom were those ex-Pentagon officials and generals that were so ubiquitous on television. Those were included as sources. So there were very many long-term, long-format interviews with pro-war voices. What it amounted to was the complete failure of the media to present a vital debate about a grave issue.
What are you doing?
Does it seem to you, along with the anti-war protesters, there are simply people who seem to be seizing on an opportunity just to come out into the streets and simply maybe cause trouble?
Absolutely, Julie.
Is traffic getting any better there, Amber?
Frank, this is a good example
no
of...
No war in Iraq! No blood for oil! No war in Iraq!
We're gonna...
No blood for oil!
You can see that
no
people...
War.
They are cooperative. They are just being very disruptive.
Bush is a terrorist! Bush is the biggest terrorist!
Yeah!
No, they're
dying.
Fuck that!
Bush! Hey, put this stuff on the news! Come on, put some real criticism!
1, 2, 3, impeach Bush! Impeach Bush!
This war is going to increase
Bush!
Terror!
Impeach Bush!
Some tried to stop KTVU photographer Martin Holton from videotaping what they were doing.
Get the fuck over! Get the fuck over!
Fuck you, gentlemen! Fuck you! Fuck you!
It's important for us to bear in mind that the great media corporations are also the great weapons corporations, the most telling example, of course, being General Electric owning NBC, but there are many other instances throughout the media enterprise and the information industries.
It is also possible for newspapers and other forms of communication to be controlled by private interests.
I thought I told you to kill that story. It'll cost us a lot of advertising.
If that story goes out, I quit.
All right.
And that the the very companies that are suppressing and trying to control and manage the images coming out of Iraq are also the companies that are profiting from the war, both directly and indirectly.
And I said, okay, who is this really? And the voice said, this is the hand.
There is no alternative but to resist the mainstream media. Now that means encouraging and working in alternative, radical or indie media or through the other channels that are available, for example in the Middle East, through Al Jazeera, Arabia, etc. And that is crucially important. I think that's not the only thing that's important though. It also means being involved in attempting to reform the mainstream media and the corporate media and to democratise them. Now in the case of the UK, we will never get proper public service, public interest reporting, unless there is some form of democratic control over the media institutions. That means, you know, direct control by the public in electing senior broadcasters, and direct control in terms of journalists through their unions, ensuring democratic communications. So I think that's part of the struggle. But I also think that media activism by itself isn't going to change the society in which we live, either at the level of media reporting or at the level of other sorts of inequalities and injustices. And so it seems to me that media activism has to be part of the wider struggle, the wider movement against corporate control and against US and UK imperialism. So I would see it, the medium activist movement, as being part of a wider struggle.
What sort of community do you live in? Where would you place it on a democracy-despotism scale? And to find out what way it is likely to go in the future, you can rate it on economic distribution and information scales. The lower your community rates on economic distribution and information scales, the lower it is likely to rate on respect and power scales, and thus to approach despotism. Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
What do we want? Real news!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Real news!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Real news!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Real news!
When do we want it?
Prometheus Radio Project, what we do is we build radio stations for community organizations, small groups that are schools or civil rights organizations. Around here you see dozens and dozens of people with cameras and microphones telling their own stories and not just relying on the corporate press to tell the story for them. So it's great to be out here.
Alternative media is the media. The rest of it is just a commercial.
Huh. مالي عن أم العراق.
Shock and awe.
If you have to ask, is this shock and awe, you're not seeing it.
We refuse to carry on business as usual while American soldiers and Iraqi civilians die under the machinery of war.
Pentagon briefing is now underway. Here's the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld.
The Pentagon's functioning. It'll be in business tomorrow.
You can turn around.
Star wheels and shields, as they're here.
Okay, what do you do about those?
Well, you probably would want to occupy. I'm going to occupy.
Boom! Nice one.
It is natural to wonder if America's future is one of fear.
Beginning to drop bombs on Iraq, as George W. Bush has done, is an escalation in unilateralism and disturbance to global peace. Just as that is an escalation, this is an escalation.
Oh my God!
What is it that the American public should be prepared for? I heard someone say yesterday, a 10-year war.
The war on terrorism is very convenient for making the rest of the world secure for capitalism.
It's a joke. There's a war on terrorism. They go to Henry Kissinger's hotel right now and place him under arrest.
I think the war on terrorism is an official paranoid push against local economies, local democracies, and I think the transnational corporate people like it.
Are we winning? Does it matter? I don't believe so. Business is good, and I thank you for your time.
American freedom free.
Free.
American freedom free.
Free.
American freedom
free.
Free.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Free.
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 God bless America.
Tighten up.
National pride.
One, two, three, four.
We say no to pushing
more.
Nobody's getting any sense of the casualties or the devastation from the media. I mean, look at how small this rally is today. Find out why we're protesting. Find out why we're protesting. Find out why we're protesting.
Spit on you! You ought to be ashamed of yourself! 3,000 people died!
Keep walking!
3,000!
Keep walking!
I don't want future generations to say, why didn't you try to stop this? Where were you? Why didn't you speak up? Why didn't you do something? And so we wore white Tyvek suits that had disarmament specialists on the front.
and in big letters, CWIT on the back, Citizen Weapons Inspection Teams. And we clipped a link in the fence, opened that up, and put our banner, Sacred Earth and Space Plowshares, on it, and then proceeded in. All the while, silently, we were saying our mantra, "Oh God, teach us how to be peacemakers in a hostile world." We just kept repeating that. And the first thing, in a plowshares action, we drew on the prophets of Micah and Isaiah of hammering swords into plowshares. And so we have two symbols, which is our blood and simple household hammers. And we had doctors take our blood ahead of time. We had them in baby bottles. And we began by pouring our blood on this concrete silo lid cover, poured our cross, our blood on there in the shape of a cross, using blood because it's what gives us life and goes through our veins. It's it represents Eucharist for us, pouring out our blood. And also it shows the messiness of war, since war is so antiseptic today.
Stop the murder for profit, the war cry.
Like. We are here to symbolize the victims of war, those who are about to die in this war. We are here to show our grief by building a memorial to the soon-to-be victims of this war. Please forgive us.
Damage to the surrounding neighborhoods and areas.
For the most part, they're extremely accurate weapon system.
By GPS, it's an excellent weapon.
Bush administration is a gangster administration. We are not going to pretend that this is not about oil. We are not going to pretend that this was an intelligence failure. We are not going to pretend that this is something we can change by being civil or by being obedient. We will not be civil with gangsters.
I'm reading this on behalf of my nephew, Staff Sergeant Mejia, who has been restricted to his base. Camilo has been to war as a soldier. While he was in Iraq, he saw no weapons of mass destruction. He saw no chemical weapons. He saw no reconstruction. What he saw was innocent people being killed, destruction, and a nation being humiliated.
Some say that Sergeant Mejia broke his oath as a soldier, and we say otherwise. All of our men and women in uniform agreed to put their lives on the line to protect country and Constitution. They signed an oath, a contract. But contracts have two sides. The government's implied vow is that it will not send our troops into reckless military misadventures, into wars for oil markets and empire building for companies like Halliburton and Bechtel. And that's the part of the contract that was broken.
Here they build the big guns.
We were here at the M27 Coalition protesting the Carlyle Group, which is a global investment fund that stands to profit mightily from the war and from the reconstruction of Iraq. George Bush Sr. is on their board of advisors, as is James Baker and Frank Carlucci. They're very tied in with the government.
Today is a national day of action against the war on Iraq. And we are saying, as long as they're making money from genocide, no more business as usual. Thank you very much. I got to go to jail now.
Across the street, there was a legal protest, people standing, holding signs, chanting, that was created as a safe space for them across the street. The cops moved in, encircled them, refused to let them leave, and arrested all of them, about 40 or 50 people who were doing nothing illegal other than holding a sign against the war. So now it's official. We are living in a police state. You are not allowed to be on the street carrying a sign saying, I am against the war. You will be arrested. It's really shocking that free speech and civil liberties are gone in America. You cannot voice your protest at all. You'll end up in jail if you do. We're not going to sit here and let our civil rights be destroyed because of some immoral war that's being done for one reason only, to make money. This war has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein or 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction. It has everything to do with corporate profits, and that's evident right here. You protest the Carlyle Group, you end up in jail.
He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch.
Motivation is empire. The other resource is water.
Hey, come join me.
I think this depiction of the pigs at the public trough exemplifies the outrageous corporate greed that has run amok in the United States.
Stephen Pelletier, who is a former CIA senior political analyst on Iraq, he wrote, America could alter the destiny of the Middle East in a way that probably could not be challenged for decades, not solely by controlling Iraq's oil, but by controlling its water. Even if America didn't occupy the country, once Mr. Hussein's Ba'ath Party is driven from power, many lucrative opportunities would open up for American companies.
Back Intel is the world's largest privatizer of water around the world, and so of course they are the obvious candidate to control Iraq's water supply. And of course, if you control people's water supply, you control their lifeline and their very lives.
Today, the United States is a grave and gathering danger.
FBI agents have new authority today to investigate suspected terrorists. New guidelines announced yesterday by the Attorney General John Ashcroft allow the FBI to monitor religious services and other public places, including the internet. And that brings us to our question of the day. Are the FBI's new powers intrusive or necessary?
It causes everybody to notice all day long that they're now in a state of higher levels of surveillance and control, which makes you uncomfortable. One way or another, it makes you uncomfortable. You know, I don't know anybody that feels more secure when they're under more control and more surveillance.
This so-called war is not a war on terrorism. It's a war on people of color. It's a war on people who are oppressed. And it's a war against people who oppose this war.
Set them free! Set them free!
My name is Mon Ami Malik, and I'm a community organizer with a group called DRUM, the Issues Rising Up and Moving, and we're out here today protesting in front of the Metropolitan Detention Center.
I'm Amira Habibi Brown. I'm the founder and executive director of the Arab American Family Support Center.
Since September, we believe that at least 2,000 people just in the New York and New Jersey area alone have been picked up in the middle of the night, often by the FBI, INS, NYPD, and locked up in detention centers.
It would be one thing if everybody that had overstayed their visa was being detained or deported or questioned, but it seemed to us that this was really focused on the Arab community and the Muslim community.
Weekly protests at Metropolitan Detention Center right here every Saturday have been going on for the past 21 weeks. There's still at least 50 to 100, we don't know the numbers of detainees in there.
We're a well-established community. We're not just a bunch of newcomers that have come here to destroy this country.
Something that affects all of America, even middle America, because we're talking about human rights for everybody. We're talking about justice. We're talking about the same things Martin Luther King talked about years and years ago.
All right, so I work at this bank. I'm not going to tell you the name of the bank because I would be fired if they found out that I was talking about this. So anyways, I work in fraud, and on September 16th, 2002, I got this request that was startling because it, first of all, was from the FBI, and it was actually, they were asking for bank statements from the one of the Al-Qaeda members who, well, the alleged Al-Qaeda members who were in Lackawanna. So I printed up these statements and sent them off. And I didn't think too much about it, but the next day, another 150 requests came in from the FBI. That weren't for these guys. These were for different people. So we had this big meeting because we had to get all these requests out in 72 hours because of this thing called the Patriot Bill or Patriot Act. I'm not sure which it is, but and you know, the day after that we got another 150 more. Every day we've gotten more and more from the FBI of these people that they're looking at who are like friends of friends of friends of these Lackawanna cell guys, you know. And I'm really scared. I'm scared for two reasons. The first is that I'm just afraid of the FBI looking at me because I'm not the most upstanding of citizens. I'm not patriotic. I don't have a flag in my window. I don't agree with anything that's going on right now. In fact, I'm really fucking scared. The other reason it scares me is because I'm doing it. Every day I'm going in for $9 an hour and printing up these documents that the FBI is demanding and that the government demands that I do. And I'm not... I'm not quitting. And just think about these people in Germany who got jobs. And I know this is a really, like, strong comparison, you know. I mean, I guess, it, you know, what I'm doing isn't quite as bad, you know. I mean, I'm not really killing anybody or anything, but, I mean, who's to say what's going to draw the line for me? I mean, you know, for $15 an hour, would I turn the gas on?
This little story that I wrote for Art Voice, you know, which went to the Humanists, which went out to the country, turns out to be a Project Censored award winner number 3, not because I did any great investigative reporting, because my reporting basically was done in my little office. The only reason why this is, you know, censored story number 3 is because nobody in this country is practicing journalism anymore. I wrote my piece about the 8,000 missing pages, about how the Iraqi weapons declaration to the UN was doctored by the US before it was released to the UN. And, you know, basically it was an important component in beating the Germans to war. And this information has been all over the European press. You know, hence, the European public opinion was overwhelmingly against the war. American public opinion was just like duh. Power to the people!
Orwell said it all much better than I could say it in this interview. War is peace and freedom is slavery. And now we're in that world. A permanent war, the enemy is East Asia, and Emmanuel Goldstein is on TV every night under the name of Bin Laden.
U.S. Labor Against the War began in Chicago on January 11th, hosted at the second largest Teamster local in the United States, Local 705 in Chicago, which is a local of truck drivers and UPS workers that had itself adopted an anti-war resolution just before U.S. law was founded that had been supported virtually unanimously by the members at the meeting where it was passed. The event on Saturday as a whole has been endorsed by about 25 labor bodies in New York City alone, representing probably around 500,000 members.
One of the problems that the labor movement has had is that the arms industry has been a big business and has employed a lot of workers and a lot of unionized workers. American labor needs to make the transition and say we need to move toward peaceful industries, peaceful energy production, safe energy production, and away from the development and manufacture of arms.
Prostitutes for 6 years, and I spent like 3 years doing HIV/AIDS education at prison, and now I'm teaching women prisoners how to read and write. So this is my cone. I represent all the social workers and the teachers. Social service blues. Bullshit, bullshit, and more bullshit. This is my butt to my ass 40 hours a week plus, so I can take home less than $800 every other week. Poem. Getting violence and dying every day of a week in America, Pony. It's all about the oil. This is mine. Don't tell me it's my duty to give back when I give back every day I go to work, Pony. Have you ever told someone 19 years old they were HIV positive, Pony? And your daddy is not coming home because he was killed by a stray bullet on his way to work, Pony? This is why I'm sorry I can't help you, because our funds have been cut. There's no food in the food pantry to give you, and this orphanage will be closing because the grant didn't get refunded, Pony. This is mine, standing on street corners with prostitutes at 2 a.m. Telling them they can find salvation and direction without getting on their knees and going back to work at 8 a.m. home. This is mine, explaining to inmates about to come home who's been gone so long, the bus takes dollar bills now. And you have to dial the area code followed by the number to dial home now. This is my tired of doing the state report, the monthly report, the Ryan White report, and the weekly report, and having my supervisor take all the credit, Pone. This is my eyes padded up to here, and look, I'm not even that tall, Pone. This is my, why is it teachers make less than professional athletes, and instead of building more prisons, let's build more schools and start after-school programs, and maybe our youth won't find a need to be Blood, Crips, and Latin Kings that would know how to read, Pone. This is my get off of Mars and start concentrating on Earth poem. Vote so Bush doesn't get reelected poem. A sixth grade girl told me she gives good head poem. This is my I'm the only female in a room full of prisoners with a dildo in my left hand and a condom in my right hand. Explain to grown men why.
Shock and awe.
Shock and awe.
If you have to ask, is this shock and awe, you're not seeing it.
We refuse to carry on business as usual while American soldiers and Iraqi civilians die under the machinery of war.
Iraqi people have great confidence in the leader and in the leadership.
I think it's a failure. Those despicable three failures, they tried again to divert the attention.
Jake, can you turn up from there?
ونقل السيد ابن يحيى للسيد الرئيس القائد نصره الله.
This is a military headquarters building in western Iraq. We attack forces defending the regime. This first image is a tank in a revetment north of Ain Nasiriyah. Coalition Special Operations Forces continued their operations and actions throughout Iraq. They're facilitating attacks against regime targets and death squads within urban areas.
بغداد ستبقى صامدة بقائدها بمقاتليها برجالها وسنبذل الغالي والنفيس من أجل بغداد العزيزة.
شكبان ليلك غضب فلك تفز بالليل دافن بصيص الأمل سهر نجوم السهر والريل فات وجزل وملك شغل بالريل حط النماذج الجمر زود سعير الويل ذوب شموع الوصل فرهد حباب الهيل بس لا يبوق العمر طيف العمر ملسوم خطار عند الفار نعرف صوان شموع خطار عند الفار نعرف صوان شموع
وهاي اللي حصلنا الامان من تون بلير ومن بوش هاي الحريه اللي وعدنا بيها داون داون بوش
داون داون بوش
راح
نروح على كل شيء
I and you live. I see you and you see me. You, I don't need a picture.
The payment that we made today was a payment of, to 36 employees totaling $720, which breaks down to $20 per employee, and that is the equal amount to the $20 emergency stopgap payment that was going to be distributed per employee.
What do you mean? It's better than nothing, no? It's
better than nothing. But we can
Thank you.
الريس فيجو.
الريس فيجو.
بولا. بستا.
ما تقول لي تصوره
اثنين هاتم لا الامريكان ولا صدام
لا انا امريكا لا امريكا
لا امريكا لا صدام
He's got hundreds of U.S. currency.
Yeah. This guy's being detained. He's got some rights. Please. He's got what?
Hey, this is one of the people. Dude, this was fucking in the backseat.
وملي اكوابي وانسي العتاب فقد نسيت عتابي مدي بساطي وملي اكوابي وانسي العتاب فقد نسيت عتابي عيناك يا بغداد منذ طفولتي شمسان نايمتان في أهدابي عيناك يا بغداد منذ طفولتي شمسان نايمتان في أهدابي لا تنكري وجهي فأنت حبيبتي وورود مائدتي وكأس شرابي لا تنكري وجهي فأنت حبيبتي وورود مائدتي وكأس شرابي بغداد جئتك كالسفينة متعبة أخفي جراحاتي وراء ثيابي بغداد جئتك كالسفينة متعبة أخفي جراحاتي وراء ثيابي
وهبطت كالعصفور يقصد عشه والفجر عرس ماذن وقبابي وهبطت كالعصفور يقصد عشه والفجر عرس ماذن وقبابي بغداد طرت على حرير عباءتي وعلى ضفائر زينب وربابي بغداد طرت على حرير عباءتي وعلى ضفائر زينب وربابي.